Have you ever wondered if you're giving your pets everything they need to truly live a happy life and one that fulfills their physical and mental well-being? Well, today we're going to discuss the needs of animals and what that means not only for your pet, but for you as a pet parent. Stay tuned. You're listening to Starlight Pet Talk, a podcast for pet parents who want the best pet care advice from cat experts, dog trainers, veterinarians, and other top pet professionals who will help you live your very best life with your pets. We also share inspiring rescue and adoption stories from people who've taken their love of pets to the next level by getting involved in animal welfare. My name is Amy Castro, and I'm the founder and president of Starlight Outreach and Rescue and a columnist for Pet Age magazine. I've rescued thousands of animals and helped people just like you find the right pet for their family. My mission is to help pet parents learn all the ways that they can care for, live with, and even have fun with their pets so they can live their very best lives and their pets can too. Welcome to Starlight Pet Talk. I'm your host, Amy Castro, and today we're going to embark on a profound and possibly controversial journey into the heart of animal welfare, exploring the five essential welfare needs that I think basically determine the quality of life for our beloved pets. And so to help us navigate this journey, my special guest today is Dr. Emma Milne. Emma is a UK veterinarian now living in France. I'm so jealous, who is best known for her animal welfare work over the last 25 years. She has written numerous books and appeared on television and radio many times to highlight animal welfare issues that are close to her heart, such as pedigree health issues, which I think we need to do a whole episode on that. But Emma, thank you so much for being here with me today to talk about this important subject.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for asking.
When we first had our conversation, we were kind of talking about what we were going to talk about. And you were the one that had mentioned the five welfare needs. Where do these welfare needs come from?
Basically, when I was at uni at vet school, we always talked about the five freedoms. And that was a way of looking at animal welfare that was, you know, very popular back in the day. And basically, during my time at uni and since then, which is a long time ago now, it developed into the five welfare needs, because the point was that the freedoms is more about avoiding suffering. And the way that evolved was that we shouldn't just be expecting animals to have a life that's free of suffering. We should be expecting them to have a life that's worth living, you know, that's better than that. So the five welfare needs got written into UK law years ago now, 2006, I think. And there's lots of different countries. There's a move now towards something called the five domains, which is, again, a slightly different model. But in the UK and a lot of the books that I've written, I've based on the five welfare needs, because I think it's a lovely way for people to think about the quality of life of their animals. And we'll touch on it today, I'm sure. You know, I sort of see three of them as physical welfare needs and two of them as mental well-being. And, you know, as we know as human animals, that your mental well-being is completely inextricably linked with your physical health. So it's a really nice way for owners to think about what their animals need and want.
Definitely. And I think, you know, as I was looking at these originally, and, you know, it's things like a healthy diet, appropriate environment, you know, ability to behave normally, health for the animal. I think most people think they're doing that, but having, and I know as a veterinarian, I'm sure you've seen the degrees. I know I see this in animal rescue, is that there is the kind of middle of the road, which I kind of see as maybe the unbiased and most appropriate for the animal. And then you see people living on either side of that, the people that think they're providing this wonderful life and they're really not. And then the people on the other extreme who go overboard with it and then they're not. You know, it's like, you know, it's from one extreme, from the bare minimum that's not really a life to the I've turned this animal into a human being, and is that really a life? So I hopefully we'll get into some of that along the way. And I'm sure you see that in your work as well.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I wrote a series of children's books, because I think that using education to change sort of entrenched beliefs and entrenched ways that people view animal welfare, kids are the future, I think. So I wrote some kids' books. Basically, I use the five welfare needs as the way that you set that out is if someone can't provide for the five needs, then that's an inappropriate pet. You know, I always view the three physical ones. They're the easiest to meet. And I think a lot of owners, you know, oh, well, I've got the right bed and the right diet and this and that. But actually, the mental well-being needs are just so important. And they're the ones that we so often get wrong. You know, the social needs and so on. So
yes, I agree. So let's go ahead and kind of dive into it. So the one I had listed as number one was the need for an appropriate or the right diet, healthy diet, and water. So
yeah.
Again, I think people think they're go ahead.
Yeah, I was gonna say I think it's one of those things that you know, you say it and it sounds so ridiculously obvious, but so many times people get diet wrong. You know, I think obviously people think about cats and dogs mostly, but in the UK, we've got lots of issues with the sort of muesli type food for rabbits that allow selective feeding and it brings all sorts of health problems. So lots of people get food and water wrong. You know, there's lots of people who, because of inconvenience to them, don't want their animals to have water at night. Well, that's like a fundamental welfare need. So it seems like an obvious one, but a lot of people get it badly wrong. And I don't know if you've got this trend in the States that we have over in Europe and the UK with raw feeding. You know, lots of people wanting to raw feed, and the health issues and the public health issues with that are absolutely enormous. So yeah, food and water you'd think would be the easiest thing to get right, and it's not.
Yeah, I know. We struggle with that a lot. I mean, I struggle with that a lot personally. I mean, I feel like I've researched the food for my pets, and then I'm changing things, and then I realize there's no way I can maintain this with my lifestyle. Because I tried when I had my Doberman Pinscher. I was like, okay, I've got this dog. I'm going to cook for him. I think the first thing is that people need to do a better job of doing their homework. And I see it all the time. And when I'm sitting at our local pet store for adoption events, and I see people walking out with food that I'm like, oh my gosh, do they even know what's in that or what's not in that?
Yeah.
And then, like you said, you know, going to that extreme of the raw food or the cooking your own food, but you haven't really done your homework. So that's one piece of it. But then I think, and I'd like for you to address this too, for all of these things, is there's a balance with some of this stuff too, because if you can't maintain, does that mean I'm a bad parent, or is it okay to find some type of a middle ground? Or is there a middle ground?
I think there's definitely middle ground. And, you know, as vets, we often have accusations thrown at us that we're profiteering from pet food and those kind of things. But, you know, when you go into a pet food shop now, there is just this overwhelming level of choice. And I think for pet parents, if that's what we're using, what term we're using, or owners, whichever you feel, it's overwhelming. And I think, you know, fundamentally, when I was a kid, we had tinned meat and biscuits, you know, and it was all a bit haphazard and random. And of course, there are dogs all over the world and cats surviving on really awful nutrition.
Right.
So it is that thing of, you know, you've got your premium foods. And personally, you know, I've got a cat now. I've had dogs and cats over the years. I've always fed them what would be considered premium pet foods. And I get frustrated with people saying that vets only recommend those foods because we make money out of them. In fact, vets make virtually no money out of pet food at all. And when I was in practice, I gave people advice based on what I did for my own animals. And it's not about profiteering. So if people can afford those good premium foods, then that's why vets are recommending them. You know, fundamentally, animals survive on all sorts of rubbish. You know, that's, you know, survival of the fittest, I guess. But, you know, some of those pet foods are actually, you know, if you look at deficiencies in our own diet, some of those premium foods are better than what most, you know, have got nutritionally better than what a lot of people are living on. Mm-hmm. So I think people shouldn't feel guilty if they can't afford those. I mean, they're really expensive in the grand scheme of things. But as long as you're feeding a, you know, balanced diet, and of course, most of the foods that you can buy now are balanced and complete, perfectly adequate to nourish your animals. I think, again, you know, going back to what I mentioned about the rabbits, we have big issues in the UK with muesli food. Well, we call it muesli style food, where they can, you know, it allows for selective feeding and so on. Mm-hmm. So I do think the pet shops have got some responsibility as well, that they, you know, if there's food that really shouldn't, from a veterinary perspective, be fed, then mm-hmm. it shouldn't be in the shops, because then, right. you know, people are going to make the right choices by default, if you like.
Right. Well, and I think in one of the things that I've learned about birds, I've always liked birds, wanted birds. I've got an issue with keeping birds in cages, so I've never owned a bird. But I have birds at the rescue now who have taken over my office, which is why my now studio is in the guest room, because I can't stand just leaving them in a cage. But I always thought birds ate seed. I didn't realize I was going to be chopping vegetables and fruit and doing all these other things. You know, you give it the seeds that they sell in the store, you keep it in the tiny cage that they sell in the store, and it lives till when it lives, and then you get another one. I mean, that's the way I always saw people treating animals like that. Same thing with gerbils, hamsters, guinea pigs. It's education on the broader sense. And we've stressed this so many times on this show, is what is the right pet for you and your lifestyle, including your budget, including your time, including your environment, and making those decisions based on, are you ready to make that commitment to that yeah. animal and what it needs? And now, you know, and we've only talked so far about food and water. And yeah. So it's really something that people really need to think about before they get any kind of pet.
Yeah. And, you know, the kids books that I wrote, so it goes through the five welfare needs, and then the children have to do a virtual month, which I think is, I love it, because my kids wanted,
brilliant.
my kids wanted to get some gerbils. So I said, right, fine, you have to do the month. Every time they've asked for a dog, I've said, right, then you walk with me twice a day for half an hour every, you know, twice every day at minimum. And I said, and then once you've done that for a month, we'll talk about whether we'll get a dog. And they're like, oh, no, I don't want to do that. It's like, and then, of course, they say, but I would if we got a dog. It's like, no, you sure. won't. You're not going to do it for a month before we've got a dog. You're definitely not doing it once we've got one for 12 years. So I think, the five welfare needs is a really nice way for people to decide whether a particular pet is right for them. And I think it's really important that we're honest about it. You know, I mean, in the States, we'll probably touch on this, but I was going through one of my talks for this conference this morning, and looking at mutilations like declawing. And I know there's still quite a few states that allow that. And it's that whole having a pet is my right, and I'll have any pet I want, whether it's, you know, if you don't want a cat to exhibit a normal behavior like scratching, then a cat isn't the right pet for you. You know, it's this, I want that, therefore I will have it. I think it's that sort of culture of what's convenient for humans isn't necessarily the best thing for the animal's welfare.
Yeah, 100%. And we get into borderline fights with people in person and on the phone, because people get incredibly offended when we deny adoptions to people who believe in declawing and are basically going to automatically declaw that pet when they get it. And they've always done that with all of their cats prior to that. And they'll sit there and argue, but I provide a fantastic home. I do this. I feed that. It's like, yeah, but that's one aspect, or maybe two aspects. That's not everything. And what makes it okay in your mind to cut off your cat's toes?
Yeah.
Because you decided to get an inappropriate sofa for your cat's environment.
Yeah.
You know?
But it is that.
Or you're not willing to take the steps to redirect. I mean, I had a discussion with a lady today who's going to be returning a dog to us because, you know, the dog keeps getting out the front door. It's like, well, how about you put a lock on the door? Well, like, you know, it's a well, but. It's like, okay, yeah. So after you give me three well, buts, you've just told me you're not willing to do what it takes to keep that pet. So just bring it back to me, you know?
Yeah.
It's like,
but it's the human convenience thing, isn't it? And I think, mm-hmm. you know, pets are really hard work. And it's one of the reasons that I think the five welfare needs is a lovely model. It's just such an easy way to decide whether an animal's a good fit for your lifestyle. Animals are a privilege, not a right. And yeah, it should be a mutually beneficial relationship.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. So let's move on to need number two, you know, which is the right environment based on that animal's, well, a lot of things, I guess. Species is probably the primary thing, correct?
Yeah. 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 So, you know, it could be something as simple as a dog bed. But I think where that need is very, very, very lacking for me is things like rabbits and the exotic pets now. You know, I'm sure it's the same in the States. We've got huge mm-hmm. increase in popularity of exotic pets like geckos and so on. And one of the problems is, I mean, you touched on it a bit with the, you know, talking about hutches and the birds in cages and so on, is that we've got this sort of legacy of, well, rabbits started being kept as pets because they were kept as meat animals. And then when people stopped eating them, well, obviously in some countries, they're still, like I live in France now, and there's still a massive trade in rabbit meat. They were kept in cages for convenience for the meat trade. And when that sort of translated into pets, now we've still got these incredibly inadequate cages. You know, as I said, with the kids, they wanted a gerbil. So they had to do their month of planning. I gave them one of the pet detective books that I'd written, said, right, okay, so you do your month. So the first week you're going to do cleaning chores around the house, which is going to represent you having to clean out these cages and so on. And we went to the pet shop and we looked at the costs, and they had to work out how much they were going to cost and all the rest of it. But one of the big issues is that so many of the pet shops sell inadequate cages. You know, it's one of the, I'm a patron of a charity in the UK called the Rabbit Welfare Association and Fund, which are brilliant and have done loads and loads of campaigning on various rabbit welfare issues. And their whole thing is trying to get big pet stores to stop selling cages that you shouldn't keep a rabbit in. You know, if you get a starter cage, or, you know, we had two gerbils. So the kids went through the whole month of doing all their research and their chores and everything. We got two gerbils and we had a huge cage for them and a bit that they could get out of. And it was absolutely massive. It took up half of the kids' bedroom. And the gerbils still spent all of their time trying to dig their way out. You know, I just think that caged small mammals are actually a significant welfare issue for me. You know, we had, they lived 3 years and they probably had an enclosure that was four times the size of most gerbils. And I said to the kids, we're never, ever having another small pet like that. If they can't have the freedom they want, then I won't have them in the house. And I think it comes back to that thing, isn't it? Is, you know, people were so used to this sort of grandfather ways of keeping pets because that's how it was always done, that we have to constantly, I think, try and check ourselves and say, well, hang on, just because we've always done that, does it mean that we should carry on doing it?
Right. Well, and I think especially with the internet nowadays, I mean, I spend a sad amount of time on TikTok, posting stuff for the rescue, but you know, then you end up scrolling and fish is another thing that I struggle with, is, you know, just the whole process of how they get here and then the environments that they live in. I just saw a video about a betta fish. So again, another one of those starter pet, let's keep it in this little thing. This young woman had shot a video of basically taking her sister's betta fish from this horrible little environment and created this, you know, huge environment for this fish. And it just got me to thinking about, people would just, again, it goes back to that education. Before they select that pet, don't rely on what you see in the store, but go out and do some research. Look at some of these videos of these, you know, appropriate habitats. And are you willing to basically, like you said, take over half your kid's bedroom? And that's still probably not 100% adequate. Are you willing to turn over a whole room? You know, the room that my birds are in is 15 by 15 or something like that. It's still a cage. It's just a giant cage, but
yeah.
It's like, maybe we shouldn't be having these kinds of pets, you know, and maybe they're not supposed to be pets. Some of these, well, I'm quite sure many of these things are not supposed to be pets.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's that whole, the human habit that we've got of, I want, therefore I can have. You know, there has to be, I think, when it comes to animal welfare, there has to be a cognitive process where someone actually asks the question, am I capable of looking after or meeting all the needs of these animals? And it's one of the reasons I use the welfare needs in loads of my talks, is because it's such a simple, it's such a simple way for people to look at their living situation, and get a pet that is going to have its welfare needs met. You know, that should be the fundamental thing that we think about when we want a pet. I love dogs, and I would love to get more dogs, but I travel a lot for work and I don't want to put them in kennels. So I don't have them. And I think it's that, you know, a lot of stuff, culture around pet keeping is, I want it, therefore I will have it. Whether it's right for the animal, you know, as you said, with the decloring and so on, well, that's inconvenient to me, so I'm going to amputate all of its digits. You know, there should be a cognitive thought process that happens before that.
Well, and even the education around, I mean, there have been many people who, you know, through education, just explaining to them, because people don't think, you know, they think declawing, oh, it's just, we're just going to, you know, take the claw off. They don't realize it's an amputation. When many people, once they hear that, they're like, oh my gosh, I would never do that. That's a horrible thing to do. It's like, but you were getting ready to do it and you didn't even bother to, you know, I mean, a quick Google search would let you know this is how this procedure works. And these are the, you know, side effects of doing it. People just do what they've always done. So they grew up with declawed cats. And so they think that's what you do with cats when they're, I mean, I've literally had people say, that's what you do with indoor cats. They don't need their claws. It's like, says you, cut your fingers off and say you don't need them.
Yeah. And also, but you're taking away, I mean, we'll come on to the behavioral needs. As I said, I sort of see the five welfare needs as three physical ones, and they're the ones that most people can get right. You know, they can buy a dog bed and they can, or a cat scratching post, or they can create an environment. They can buy dog food or pet food, and you know, they can take them to the vets when they're poorly. Those are the physical things, but their mental health needs are so much more difficult to meet and are what we get wrong so much of the time.
And I think a lot of the environment and behavior things do go together. So I'm holding one other thought that I was going to bring up until we get to kind of the behavior. But let's go ahead and hit the third physical one, which is basically protection from pain, injury, and disease. And like you mentioned, you know, most people, well, you'd be surprised how many people I run into that don't believe that their animals need regular veterinary care, but most people do realize that there is at least a minimum standard for that. But there's also, I think, many places where people go wrong on that. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because it's a personal issue that I have struggled with in animal rescue, is how far do we go to fix a physical injury in an animal? Do we save an animal that we know is going to be paralyzed so that we can put it on wheels and expect it to live its life? I have a real hard time with that. But I also, I think it was probably about 2 years ago, we had a kitten that had severe damage to its eyes, and it had other issues as well. So we euthanized it because we figured its quality of life would be that poor. Literally 2 weeks later, we get a litter of kittens. All of them have eye issues. Long and the short of it is, one of them's eyes are so bad that we did remove both of her eyes, and I still have her. And, you know, it was a struggle back and forth to decide. And I try to think that I did it logically and did it with the animal's best interest in mind, because having done rescue for so long and having thousands of animals, I don't feel like my personal feelings play into it a lot, because I almost feel like I don't have a lot of them left. But yeah. I question, did I do the right thing? You know, she's living in my house, seemingly happy, but is she? I mean.
Yeah, but I think it's one of those things that's tricky, because even within the veterinary profession, there's so many different opinions. Personally, I think it is trickier for cats because they live in a three-dimensional way. I probably wouldn't have done that, because the cat won't be able to jump or hunt or climb. I don't know if she does, but she'll probably spend more time.
What this cat does.
living. Yeah. So, it's difficult, isn't it? Because you make those decisions based on what your gut feeling is. So, I don't know. Personally, I wouldn't. But then, as you say, she may be having a completely normal quality of life. I think one of the things that we always try to get across to owners when we're talking about animal welfare, and it's something that people really struggle with, is that euthanasia is a treatment option. You know, it's, and I think, as you said, we're touched on already with the, you know, paralyzed animals and how far do you go? And that's always going to have to be decisions that are made between an owner and their vet. And, you know, as I say, there are vets that do things that I would definitely never do, you know, like whole tongue amputations in a cat. You're basically taking away its behavioral need to groom. But, you know, I think this whole, the need to be protected from pain, injury and disease comes back again to, as we were chatting the other day before the recording, my biggest, I guess what I'm best known for is my work on pedigree health issues. And I think a lot of these disabling pain, injury and disease questions are preventable because we're creating breeds of animals that are incapable of living healthy lives. So, right. You know, you look at grooming and things and that side of things, and you've got things like sphinx cats that have got no fur. Mm-hmm. So they can't groom. They're self-traumatizing because they've got barbed tongues. They can't go out. So we've created animals that are incapable of living normal lives, behaviorally, and full of physical suffering. And I think that we should be asking ourselves huge ethical questions about a lot of the breeds that we've created, because they're incapable. You know, we wouldn't need to have massive industry selling carts for Dachshunds and French Bulldogs now, you know, if they didn't all have intervertebral disc disease. So, you know, I think a lot of the talks I do are about extreme conformation. And I think we cause a massive amount of physical suffering by selecting for body shapes that are dysfunctional.
We're going to take a super quick break and we'll be right back. Our pets aren't in our lives nearly long enough, so isn't it important that we build the best relationship with them that we can? Let us help. Get our exclusive guide, 10 Tips for Building a Lifelong Bond with Your Pet, and start transforming your relationship today. Get it at bit.ly/bondwithmypet. I had a discussion at a dinner table at a professional event, and we were talking about, you know, because there's a lot of people in rescue who are like anti-breeding dogs in any way, shape, or form. And I kind of have this belief that I can see the value in breeding certain breeds of dogs, because certain breeds of dogs, especially working dogs, you're not going to have a Shih Tzu being a protection dog, or a herding dog, or a livestock protection animal. And so I can see the value in breeding certain animals to do certain jobs, because that's what we do with animals, and then providing the appropriate lifestyle for them. But the comment that I made that got everybody mad is I said, but I can see no value whatsoever in breeding cats, because what does it matter? You know, it's like, do we need different breeds of cats? And the Sphinx is a perfect example, because one gentleman very offended by that. And it's like, well, I couldn't have a cat because I'm allergic to cats. So that's the only kind of cat that I can have. And I stopped myself because I didn't want to start a fight at the dinner table. But the issue is, then don't get a cat. You don't have a right to have a cat. You know, maybe you just need to get a dog, or maybe you don't get a pet. Sorry.
Yeah. You know, but it is that, it's that right, not a privilege thing. And I, you know, I come back to this all the time in the welfare work that I do. You know, of course, people's circumstances change. So you may have a pet and then lose a job, or, you know, things happen in life. I know it's not always, you know, the ideal that we'd want, but deliberately getting an animal that is an unsuitable pet and then choosing one that can't have a normal life. So the declawing or having a sphinx because you're allergic. And actually we all know that most allergies are to skin, so it's probably nothing to do with the fur. It's people picking pets for their own convenience is fundamentally one of the biggest issues that I have in the welfare work that I do. You know, it's like there was a survey done by the Kennel Club in the UK years ago that found that most people spent more time picking a pair of shoes than they did picking a pet. And I think that that is an incredibly worrying statistic. You know, we live in this instant access culture. One of the big campaigns that I do is people not sharing images of animals with conformational problems as cute or funny or, you know, those kind of things. But it is that, oh, someone sees that the Rock's got a French bulldog, therefore, oh, I'll buy a bulldog. And 2 minutes later, click, you've bought a French bulldog puppy. With no thought process of, can I meet that animal's needs? Do I even know what its needs are? Is it going to be healthy? And, you know, the French bulldogs are a classic example. They're number one in the US now, as well as the UK, I think, popularity wise. Yeah. And they are destined to suffer. There is no two ways about it. But it's that sort of instant click culture that we live in, isn't it? It's like, I like the look of that. I see a celebrity with it, therefore I will have it. Humans are sometimes a very disappointing species, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And, well, you yeah. must see that in, you know, rescue circles and so on.
And the problem is they get so entrenched in that regardless of the factual statistical information that you provide them, they don't care. I mean, it's terrible to say that they don't care, but they don't, because there wouldn't be French bulldogs coming out of our ears. We have one in the rescue now that came in. She's a mess. I mean, the dog can't even squat to poop. Her body is so messed up. We call her Grammy Gremlin because she doesn't even look like a dog. She's such a mess. And you know, I provide her great care and I love her and she's a little clown, but I wish she was never born. I mean, it's terrible to say that. I mean, I can sit at the pet shop. And so somebody said, oh, there's another French bulldog back getting groomed. And I was so like, I couldn't even say anything when I saw this animal. It was not recognizable as even a French bulldog for that matter. It was so malformed. It was shocking. And having such a hard time breathing, and then it sneezed and had all this green snot coming out of its nose. And it's like, oh, he's just got allergies. And I'm thinking, oh my God, get that dog away from me, please. I mean, it's just, people just, they blind themselves to it.
Yeah.
And they probably paid thousands of dollars for that mess of a dog.
Yeah. And this is the thing. There's a really amazing scientist that I know well in the UK called Rowena Packer, and she does a lot of work on the brachycephalic issues. But they've done a lot of research into why people continually get them. The average lifespan of a French bulldog, according to one of the surveys that came out in the UK recently, is 4.5 years. I mean, my two crossbreeds, the last two I had, lived 15. The one I had before that was 16. It's personal anecdote, it's not evidence, but you know, we know that crossbreeds live longer than pedigree animals. And when you've got what should be a small, vivacious dog that can't make it past the age of 4, someone has to ask themselves ethical questions about whether we should be breeding those animals. And of course, you know, their quality of life is pretty poor in a lot of ways. But going back to Rowena's work, one of the studies that came out of the Royal Veterinary College where she works is that, people, even if they have loads of health problems with things like French bulldogs, they, when questioned, would you get another one? They say yes, they would. And I think, yeah, and there is a definite phenomenon on the whole spectrum of pet ownership where some people actively want animals that are disabled because they want to care for them. You know, and so, you know, I've had people say to me, oh, well, you shouldn't want to ban bulldogs because, oh, I spend hours cleaning out the skin folds of my bulldog. And they say it in a way that it's like, oh, he has more facial. Yeah, it's that he has more a longer skincare routine than I do. And my point is, it's like, but if you have a dog shaped dog, they don't need a skincare routine. Like they, it's such this bizarre point that we've got to where people accept and actively go out of their way to buy animals that are dysfunctional so that they can care for them.
It's almost like a Munchausen by proxy kind of thing.
Yeah. humans have this desire, and I think some of the quirky dog and cat breeds, they really sort of feed into that desire for attention seeking, you know, and dogs, I think, have suffered more than cats for that because people parade them outside their house. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of psychological issues to combat, I think.
Yes, we need to get Dr. Phil or somebody on that. All right, so let's go ahead and move on to the tougher stuff. Need number four, you know, the need to express natural behavior.
Yeah.
And again, I think that's another thing that people don't have any clue. You know, there's the extremes. Either they have no clue, or there's so many people that, you know, still are equating natural behavior in dogs to wolves and other things. And it's like, yeah, I think they, in many ways, have evolved past that. So that may not be accurate either. Where are you seeing us go wrong as humans in this area?
Oh, I think these are massive. I mean, the behavioral and social needs, which are the two, you know, as I see them, the two sort of psychological needs, I think are really inextricably linked. So if you're happy to, let's talk about both of them together.
Yes. Yeah, because five was whether they need companionship or whether they need to be with other animals, which some animals do and some animals don't.
Yeah. So yeah, and let's I think these two mental well-being needs are hugely misunderstood. So in the UK, we've got, I don't know what it's like in the States, but in the UK, we have about 1.5 million rabbits are kept as pets. And the social needs are a real big one because, you know, if you want a rabbit, but not two rabbits, then a rabbit isn't the right pet for you because they have social needs. They're social animals. Classic thing was that people would think, well, I'm going to have this beautiful environment for my pet rabbit, so they won't need to dig. Well, you can't take away an innate need that an animal has. You know, rabbits want to dig. So if you want to be a good owner for a rabbit, you have to provide them with something that they can dig in. And it's this kind of human convenience thing. So, oh, I don't really want a big hutch and a run. I don't want the garden getting nibbled. Then a rabbit isn't the right pet for you. Cats are solitary animals, and loads of crazy cat ladies have got millions of them. Their behavioral needs are really misunderstood. So cats are really subtle communicators. The first two kids' books that I wrote were cats and rabbits because they're the most misunderstood pets. And it's really difficult to get their behavioral and social needs right. So we already talked about declawing. You know, a normal cat behavior that they need to exhibit is clawing. It's conditioning for their claws, it's scent marking, it's this massive behavioral need. If you don't want a cat to claw stuff in your house, then a cat isn't the right pet for you. Going back to the extreme conformation, one of the talks I'm doing this week at this conference in Orlando is the behavioral impact of extreme conformation as well, because I think we're really used to talking about the physical stuff. But when you look at, for instance, well, as we touched on earlier with the Sphinx cats, can they groom properly? Can they do this fundamental behavioral need that they have? And I think meeting those behavioral needs is something that's massively misunderstood and neglected across pet keeping. The behavior and social needs are something that really need much more investment from owners.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode where we hit the first three of the five animal welfare needs and gave you a bit of a teaser and a taste for the final two. Be sure to listen to next week's episode where we will dive deep into those final two animal welfare needs, which are the ones that probably most of us get the most wrong. So stay tuned and we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Starlight Pet Talk. Be sure to visit our website at www.starlightpettalk.com for more resources, and be sure to follow this podcast on your favorite podcast app so you'll never miss a show. If you enjoyed and found value in today's episode, we'd appreciate a rating on Apple. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would be great too. Don't forget to tune in next week and every week for a brand new episode of Starlight Pet Talk. And if you don't do anything else this week, give your pets a big hug from us.